This is the Rental Income Podcast, where we talk to owners of rental properties and give you actionable tips and advice that will help you make more money while dealing with less hassle. And now your host, Dan Lane.
I put together a list of 7 things I wish I knew earlier about renting properties, and you can download your free copy. Just go to my website, freelandlordgift.com. All right, on the show today, we have Jim Adams, and Jim has just a heartbreaking story. This is really, really horrible. So Jim was an executive at a big insurance company. He had a really good job. He was making lots and lots of money. And then things went bad. He ended up losing his job. So he was looking for a way to replace his income. And in insurance, you have residual income. So every time the customer pays their policy, you get paid. So he was looking for a way to generate residual income. And he stumbled upon owning rental properties. And he thought this would be a really good way to generate some passive residual income. It was kind of a model he was familiar with. So he ended up buying some properties. But instead of buying a property or 2 properties or 3 properties, Jim ended up stumbling upon an estate sale where they were selling 70 properties. So he bought the 70 properties, and then he found another 30 that he bought on his own. So he had a total of 100 rental properties. Things were going great. He was making lots of money. He had a staff of 20 people at one point that were working with him. So he basically built an empire in a short period of time. 100 rentals, staff of 20, things were going awesome. He was making lots of money. Things were really going great. And then the market crashed and things got bad and he ended up losing all of the rental properties. He got foreclosed on 100 times and he also ended up losing his personal house. He ended up getting both of his cars repossessed. Things got so bad that at one point he actually had to pawn his wedding ring to feed his wife and his 4 small kids. I mean, just a heartbreaking story. And I hate hearing stories like this. You know, on this show, we talk to a lot of people that are really successful in owning rental properties. And I think maybe they can make it seem real easy. And maybe they've had good luck and maybe things have come easy to them. But you know, I thought it might be interesting today to maybe show a different side of the story and show someone that things didn't go so smoothly to, and maybe we could learn something so that this doesn't happen to me or doesn't happen to you at some point in the future. So I want to find out today what Jim would do differently, and I also want to hear about how he rebuilt his life, because losing such a big business, losing your house, losing all your cars, I mean, that is just a horrible, horrible thing to go through. So I want to find out how he rebuilt his life after all this. So, Jim, I've got so many questions that I want to ask you. My first question is, why did you start with 70 properties? Why not buy 1 or maybe 2 or maybe 3 properties? Why did you go big at the very beginning and buy 70 properties?
The reason I started with 70 is because I'm not trying to replace a $30,000 a year job. You know, I'm in, you know, really mid 6 figures. So, hey, I need a big block of houses. Right. So that was my thinking in my mind for starting with 70. But if I had it to do over again, I absolutely would not start that big.
Okay, so I really want to help people avoid having this happen to them. So what do you think you would do differently if you were starting over again?
Well, I mean, I would do so many things different. You know, we have 4 children. 2 of them are heavily into real estate investing, and one kind of, you know, and one, this one is just out of college, but does it a little bit. And I tell them, you know, if I was starting over, and I don't know, you know, how much you guys have talked about this, but I would start, my model right now would be buying houses subject to. Sometimes, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard this saying, having money works against you.
What do you mean by that?
Okay. So with $250,000, you know, enough to put down on the 70 houses, I mean, I did things, let's say if I didn't have any money. Okay, well, then you've got to be creative. You got to start with 1 house, then 2, then 3. Okay, but since I had money, it allowed me to, I will say this, I was about to say it allowed me to go faster than I was ready. But now let me say this. Before I bought the 70 houses, the semester I spent in seminary, those 4 or 5 months I spent carefully preparing, studying, reading. I had a really exhaustive property management manual. The other part that came with the 70 houses, there was also a property manager in place. So here's what I said. I said to her, I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take 30 days. At the end of 30 days, I'm going to decide if I want to keep you, and you decide if you want to stay. So this lady had been managing the properties, you know, for the, you know, now deceased owner for 5 or 6 years. But to tell you how much time and preparation I put into this, when we took over the properties and Angel came on board, oftentimes she would ask me a question. Hey, I got this issue that came up. What do you want to do about it? And literally it was fascinating to say, hey, Angel, we've already addressed that. Look, it's in the property management manual, you know, under section 2, you know, page 17. Mm-hmm. And she was like blown away. She's like, I've been doing this for 6 years. We never had these kind of systems in place. So I don't want the listeners to think I just woke up one morning and decided to buy 70 houses. I mean, we spent, you know, countless hours preparing. Now, we didn't know it was going to be 70 houses, but preparing to get started.
Okay. So would you have taken your cash and bought houses, just cash, not financed anything?
No. And certainly would have taken all of my cash. And I probably would have been very limited in how much, you know, because it, taking the subject to approach, and I liked it for a number of reasons, because, by the way, my houses were lower end properties, by the way. Okay. So now the thing I like about the subject to approach is that it doesn't require as much cash. It allows you to get, and I bought houses subject to, you know, that I'm going to keep for lease to own, you know, properties. It allows me to get into a much higher end house, you know, because I don't need $200,000 to buy the $300,000 house now.
And explain how subject to works.
So you got a homeowner who's, and there's so many keys, who's behind on their loan. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they're not in foreclosure. There may be pre-foreclosure, and there are all kind of systems you got to put in place, because if they're 4 months behind, that may be more cash than I want to put out to catch them up. But long story short, you're buying a house subject to the existing mortgage. And with the paperwork in place, the loan, you know, there are two parts to a mortgage. There's the actual loan, and of course, then there's the deed. So the deed transfers from the homeowner to you, but the mortgage stays in their name, if I'm making sense.
Okay.
And so you basically walk in and take over their payments. So there are all kind of formulas and algorithms that, of course, we had a software program, but some questions to ask: how many months behind is the loan? Okay, how many? What's the monthly payment that you're taking over? And of course, at that time, you know, is it fixed? Is it an adjustable rate mortgage? But ultimately, you're getting to this question: hey, the payment right now is $1,200. This is a house that I rent for $1,500. And by the way, our model was, if there wasn't at least a $300 spread between the payment and the lease amount we could get, you know, we didn't do the deal. But it didn't require you getting any financing, any approval. I mean, this is literally a model that somebody could build a pretty good rental portfolio with, who doesn't have, you know, stellar credit or a lot of cash to start with. So I know that's kind of a long rambling statement to try to answer the subject to question.
Okay. So back to what you would do differently. So you would buy fewer houses. Is there anything else you would do differently to if you could go back in time?
Well, you know, I would buy nicer houses, which is the whole point about the subject too, you know, because, you know, most of my houses were HUD rentals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I would buy fewer houses. I would buy nicer houses. Let's say at the medium home price, I don't know what it is. Let's say it's $160,000. You know, I would be medium plus $20,000 probably at a minimum.
Okay.
You know, okay. So I would not buy, you know, the 30, 40, you know, $45,000 houses like I bought.
So is that just because with a higher end house, you're going to maybe have better tenants, less hassle?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And here's the thing, especially now, because see, here's the thing now, back to the market overcorrecting. There are a number of people, great tenants, who lost their house. Hey, I'm one of them. Okay.
Right.
So in the aftermath of losing our house for whatever it was, 2, 3, 4 years, we've been renters. Okay. I've not missed a single payment. I've not been late a single time. Hey, but I can't qualify to buy a house. So there are millions of people like me. You know, I'm not going to stay. Well, you know, be careful what you're not going to do. I don't want to stay in the $50,000 house.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I want to stay in something as close as possible as to what I used to live in. And there are a number of people like that who can't qualify for a home, but would be great tenants now, you know. So especially now, I would be looking in that market.
So, all right. So after you got foreclosed on, and tell me this: like, is there a difference between being foreclosed on one time and being foreclosed on 100 times? Like, is your credit just jacked either way?
Well, let me say this. You know, and I talked to my bankruptcy attorney, who was a good friend of mine. I said, hey, is there any way we can avoid this? And he said, if I've ever seen a candidate for bankruptcy, it's you. So the great – well, I shouldn't say the great thing. The shining light in the middle of a really stormy, cloudy day with bankruptcy is, I mean, it's kind of a clean slate. So other than the bankruptcy actually on your credit, I mean, your credit scores kind of zoom up actually. So for me, let me ask you a question like this. Being foreclosed on 100 times, hey, it's out of my control. It's not like I gambled the money away. You know, hey, there's right. nothing I can do about that. Losing your personal home and not sure where you're going to live, that's a whole different thing.
That sure
that's
is.
That's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
And Dan, you know, the way we initially met, you know, the wife and I do a podcast, of course, nothing to do with real estate, it's on family, the Family Matters First podcast. Mm-hmm. But we tell the story, you know, how does a family go through financial bankruptcy but remain relationship rich? So literally, you know, my wife and I have been married for 29 years. We have 4 children. I mean, the marriage, if anything, is stronger, but it was a really uncomfortable time.
I
don't
bet.
Mean just
yeah.
in a relationship. I mean, literally with, like, where are we going to live?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how. I mean, were there times where, like, the relationship just got so tough just with all that pressure and the stress on the relationship? Like, did you ever think, I don't know if we're going to make it?
No, that good. Never. As a matter of fact, we were sitting around the table, the whole family, we're big on family dinners, and we were sitting around the table, the 6 of us at the time, and I said to the kids, tell me what you see in my eyes. In other words, is the story I'm telling you about my faith and my convictions, I want to see if it's really real in the midst of this really hard situation. So tell me what you're seeing. My youngest, Elizabeth, I mean, Elizabeth's 22 now. She's whatever, you know, 14 at the time, 15, whatever she was. She said, this is her response. Hey, Dad, if anything, you look happier and calmer than I've ever seen. That's literally what she said.
Well, that's great.
So, wow. So no, the relationship was never, you know, threatened, but just some really practical things, you know, where we're going to live, what are we going to do for money, you know, just a number of things like that.
So how did you rebuild your life? It seems like you're back. Your life was really, really difficult, I'm sure, for a while there. But you seem to rebuild after this. How did you get out of that? How did you get back on top again?
Well, and of course, you know, financially, we're nowhere close to where we were. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what I did, you know, back to that starting out going to seminary, for 5 years, I worked full time in ministry. And that's always been something I wanted to do. It's always been a calling. But quite honestly, just, you know, you don't get paid very much doing that, right?
Right.
Okay,
right.
So now when I'm at zero, now I can take the job, which the job I took paid $36,000 a year. I mean, you know, less than I used to make in a month. But when you're at zero, you can do that. So we're doing what we really like, you know, and back to the whole bankruptcy. I mean, when you're starting from scratch, you know, hey, you're not making much money, but you don't need much money.
But how do you change your lifestyle? I mean, to go from making $500,000 a year to making $36,000 a year, that's a major shift in the way you live. Like, how did you do that?
Well, I mean, and we're still making adjustments. I mean, back to that conversation at the dinner table, I mean, because we would have regular family meetings about, okay, guys, you know, here's some stuff we can't do anymore. Of course, now all of our kids are grown now and gone. But at the time, you know, the kids that were home, it was a hard adjustment. But I mean, I guess the best way I can answer it, you do what you have to do. So when there's 36,000, of course, now that's after me being out of work 7 months. You know, the wife, who my wife has always been a stay-at-home mom, other than helping with, you know, with some of the different businesses we'd run. So I tell you a story where we went to seminary. I left after that semester, bought the 70 houses. My wife remained in seminary, got her master's. So now at this point, she's working, which prior to that, she'd never really, you know, worked a job. You know, so at this point, she's making maybe 36, 37,000. I'm at zero. I get the job at 36,000. So collectively, we're at 72,000. And I mean, we got no house. We got no car payments. We had very little debt. The debt we had anyway, business debt, was wiped out in the bankruptcy. So it's, again, I guess the best way I can answer it, you'd be surprised with how little you can get by on when you don't have a choice. Right. And I don't want any of the listeners going like, well, you're making $72,000. You know, that's not a little, but relatively speaking, you know what I mean?
Right. Sure. Well, Jim, I got to hand it to you. It seems like you've really, you first of all, you have just an incredible attitude. And really just a great story on rebuilding your life. And you, like you said, you talk about this more in your podcast. Why don't you tell us where we can find you to,
We tell our story, and again, you know, it's not, although real estate's a big part of our story, nothing that, you know, the audience is going to find is going to talk about real estate. But of course, they can visit us at Family Matters First. And of course, first is all spelled out, familymattersfirst.org. And they can actually listen to the podcast, you know, on our website, or they can find us in iTunes. It's the Family Matters First podcast. They can find us on Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud. And in our, we do a series on finances, and we tell a little bit of the story, actually not the detail that we've gone into in your show. I think this is the most I've probably ever shared publicly, you know, because this is, you know, the appropriate form. It's about real estate. But at the Family Matters First podcast in iTunes, or at familymattersfirst.org, they can listen to us talk about marriage and family and parenting and so forth.
It's a great show. I've listened to a few of the episodes, and I think our audience would really like your show. Well, Jim, we got to wrap things up, but before we do, I want to get into the lightning round. Are you ready to do this real quick?
I'm ready.
All right.
Now, the Rental Income Podcast Lightning Round. 5 rapid fire questions and answers in 60 seconds.
All right. Our first question is, what's your favorite real estate book?
Hey, the best book, the most helpful book I read, are you familiar with Robert Sheman?
I am. Yes.
You know, I like, you know, Robert, just his writing style, it really resonates with me. So Secrets of a Millionaire Landlord is basically how I built what I thought was one of the most effective property management companies that, I mean, because I went from managing my own properties to managing properties for dozens of clients. So I'm a big Robert Sheman fan, and Secrets of a Millionaire Landlord probably was my favorite / most helpful book I read on property management at the time.
All right. The number one fear that I hear from people all the time on why they don't want to own rental properties is they don't want to get a call at 3 a.m. that a toilet's clogged. As a landlord with 100 properties, have you ever gotten this call?
Hey, I never got that call, but here's the great thing about that. It's funny you mentioned that, because I got that question a million times, or that concern. But now, and actually, that was kind of the impetus to the business model. Okay, hey, Jim, I want to own some property, but I don't want to get that call. So hey, Joe, if I could buy the house, fix it up, put a tenant in there and manage it for you, I'll take that call. Do you want to own rental property? Jim, I want to own as many as I can. That's actually how our business got started.
That's
from
great.
From that concern.
And that call never came in, even when...
No, that call never came in.
All right, question number 3. If you had a property sitting vacant for 6 months, you had a potential renter apply that had horrible credit, a spotty work history, and a spotty rental history, would you take a chance on them and rent to them, or let the property sit?
I've got two answers. Well, I've got one answer, really. What the answer should be in theory is no, absolutely, positively, 1,000 times no.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of the matter is, when you're sitting out there with 40, 50, 60 properties, and or maybe better, even 4, 5, 6 properties, maybe it's a bigger deal then, and you've got one vacant, the temptation, the tendency is to do that. But you're, and this is why I say, Dan, you should decide before you have to decide. So at the very beginning, you put some goals in place and some parameters in place, and then stick to what you put in place before you were in any kind of pressure. So the answer should be no.
Okay. All right. Number 4, if you had to give one piece of advice to a new landlord, what would it be?
start small, learn as much as you can, have a, and I know this is more than one, have a system in place, have a set of checks and balances, goals, have everything in place before you buy your first house, and try to answer as many questions as you can before you are forced to in the heat of the moment. What are we going to do about dogs and pets and so forth? What are we, how are we going to handle people who pay late? I mean, try to get all those things. When I say answered, have a way of dealing with that before you're actually forced to make that decision.
That's good advice. Having systems makes your life so much easier.
Exactly.
All right. And number five, would you rent a property to your best friend?
Okay. Now, okay, that goes back to the last question, actually. Now, follow me on my answer. Yes, I would. Here's why. Because I don't own any properties. I mean, I never, ever, ever will let anybody, nobody, you know, the fact that you know that I own this many properties, I mean, I'm not sure anybody else knows that story. So I would rent to anybody. Why? Because I'm just the lowly landlord. I'm just following instructions. Hey, best friend, I can't pay. Hey, I'm, you know, the straw man, you've heard this story, the straw man?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So I've got no problem renting to my best friend because I'm not the landlord. I the company that I own, Dan, I work for this company. And you can under who's the owner? I'm not even sure. So you can understand, best friend, why you've got to be put out if it comes to that.
Right.
I don't make that call. Does that make sense?
That does. No. Yeah, I think that's a really good way to set it up. So basically, you have an LLC or something, and you know you never present yourself as the owner. You're the property
exactly.
manager.
Yeah. Exactly. And of course, we did property inspections, and early on, I did those myself. So I would get asked this question a million times. Every tenant, who owns? Because you remember, because I bought existing properties. Who's the new owner? I don't know. Some company. I'm not sure. I mean, I never said I was the owner. Never.
Right. That way, you don't have to be the bad guy. You know,
exactly.
you can say, "Well, listen, you know, you're going to be late on the rent. Let me check with the owner and see what he says." And you know,
and I don't want that to come across as cowardly. To me, that's just and the fact of the matter is, when you do have your properties in an LLC, you do not own the properties. I mean, the LLC
right.
does.
Right. Yeah. That's good. I think that's a really, really good strategy. All right. Well, Jim, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I've really appreciated talking to you and hearing your story. And we're going to have the show notes. If you want to review anything we talked about today, you can find that at rentalincomepodcast.com/episode9. Thanks a lot, Jim. And tell us one more time where we can find your podcast.
Hey, Dan, thanks so much for the opportunity. FamilyMattersFirst.org.
All right. Well, thanks for tuning in. My name is Dan Lane, and this is the Rental Income Podcast.